This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Notorious 19 by Janet Ivanovich. Read for you by Lorelei King. Chapter 1.
I don't know why we gotta sit here baking in your car in the middle of the day, in the middle of the summer, in the middle of this crummy neighborhood, Lula said. It must be 200 degrees in here. Why don't we have the air conditioning on?
It's broken, I told her.
Well, why don't you have your window open?
It's stuck closed.
Then why don't we take my car? My car's got everything.
Your car is red and flashy. People notice it and remember it. This is the stealth car, I said. Lula shifted in her seat.
Stealth car, my big toe. This thing is a hunk of junk.
This was true, but it was my hunk of junk, and due to a professional dry spell, it was all I could afford. Lula and I work for my cousin Vinny's bail bonds office in Trenton, New Jersey. I'm a fugitive apprehension agent, and Lula is my sometimes partner. We were currently parked on Stark Street doing surveillance on a rooming house, hoping to catch Melvin Barrel coming or going. He'd been accused of possession with intent to sell. Vinny bonded him out of jail, and Barrel hadn't shown for his court date. Lula makes a wage as the office file clerk, but I only make money if I catch skips, so I was motivated to tough it out in my hellishly hot car, hoping for a shot at snagging Barrel.
I worked the street when I was a hoe, Lula said, but I was in a better section. This here block is for losers. No high-class hoe would work this block. Darling Gooch worked this block, but it turned out she was killing people as a hobby.
Lula was fanning herself with a crumpled fast food bag she'd found on the floor in the back of my car, and the smell of stale French fries and ketchup wafted out at me.
You keep waving that bag around, and we're going to smell like we worked the fry station at Cluck in a Bucket, I said to her. I hear you, Lula said. It's making me hungry, and much as I like the aroma of food grease, I don't want it stuck in my hair on account of I just had my hair done. I picked out the piña colada conditioner so I'd smell like a tropical island.
Lula's hair was fire engine red today and straightened to the texture of boar bristle. Her brown skin was slick with sweat. Her extra voluptuous plus-size body was squeezed into a size 2 petite poison green spandex skirt, and the acres of flesh that constituted her chest overflowed a brilliant yellow spaghetti strap tank top. At 5'5", she's a couple inches shorter than me. We're about the same age, which puts us in the proximity of 30-something, and we're both single. My name is Stephanie Plum, and I haven't got Lula's body volume or the attitude that goes with it. My attitude goes more toward survival mode. I have shoulder-length curly brown hair, blue eyes almost always enhanced by a swipe of black mascara, decent teeth, a cute nose in the middle of my face, and I can almost always button the top button on my jeans.
Look at this fool coming at us walking down the middle of the street, Lula said. What the heck is he doing?
The fool was a skinny guy dressed in homey clothes, baggy pants, wife-beater t-shirt, $700 basketball shoes. He was jogging more than walking, and every couple steps he'd look over his shoulder and scan the street. He spotted Lula and me, made a course correction, and ran straight for us. He reached my car, grabbed the driver's side door handle, and yanked, but nothing happened.
What's with that? Lula asked.
My door's stuck, I said. It happens when it gets hot. The skinny guy had his face pressed to my window, and he was yelling at us.
What's he saying? Lula asked. I can't make it out, and I'm gonna go blind from the sun reflecting on his gold tooth with a diamond chip in it.
I think he's saying if I don't open the door, he'll kill me.
That don't sound appealing, Lula said. Maybe this is a good time to go get lunch.
I turned the key in the ignition, and the engine cranked over and died. I turned it again, and there was silence. I looked back at the skinny guy and realized he had a gun pointed at me. Not just any old gun, either. This gun was big.
Open your door, he yelled. Open your damn door.
Lula had her purse on her lap and was fumbling around in it.
I got a gun in here somewhere, she said. Keep him busy while I find my gun.
I fidgeted with the door handle on my side so it would look like I was trying to open it. Here's a plan, I said to Lula. When you find your gun, you let me know so I can duck down and you can shoot him.
That would be a good plan, Lula said, but I might not have my gun with me. I might have left it home when I changed from my red purse to my yellow purse. You know how I am about the right accessories.
The guy was really agitated now.
He had the gun against my window, and his forehead was glued to the gun like he was sighting for the kill.
"Maybe you should open the door and see what he wants," Lula said. "Maybe he just feels like going for a ride, in which case he could have this piece of dog-duty car, and I'd be happy to take a bus home."
"Hold on," I yelled at the guy. "I'm gonna open the door."
"What?"
he yelled back. "Hold on." I hauled back and rammed the door full force with my shoulder. The door flew open, catching the guy by surprise. The gun discharged, and he went down to the ground and didn't move. We got out of the car and stared down at the guy. He was statue still and bleeding from his forehead.
"You killed him," Lula said. "You hit him with the door and he shot himself."
"It was an accident."
"Don't matter. You killed him all the same."
Lula towed him, but he still didn't move.
"Yep," she said. "He's dead."
I looked at my car and realized a bullet was embedded in the roof just over the window. I bent down and took a closer look at the skinny guy. "He's not shot," I said. "He got hit in the head when the gun kicked back. He's just knocked out."
"Huh," Lula said. "That would have been my second theory."
We dragged him to the gutter so he wouldn't get run over, and we got back into my car. I tried the key, but there was no response.
"I bet your battery's no good," Lula said. "That's my professional opinion. You're going to have to call someone to juice up your battery. And in the meantime, I'm going across the street to that sad-ass grocery store to get a soda. I'm all dehydrated."
I crossed the street with Lula. We got sodas, and we stood in front of the store, chugging them down. A black Cadillac Escalade rolled down the street and stopped by my car. Two idiots wearing gang colors got out, scooped the skinny guy up, and threw him into the Escalade. A yellow Hummer careened around the corner, jerked to a stop half a block in front of the Escalade, and two guys in the Hummer leaned out the window and opened fire. The Escalade returned fire. A guy wearing a crooked ball cap popped his head out of the sunroof on the Hummer, aimed a rocket launcher at the Escalade, and phoomph! The rocket went wide of the Escalade and blew up my car. There was a moment of silence, then both cars roared away. Lula and I stared wide-eyed and open-mouthed at the fireball consuming my car. "Jeez Louise," I said.
"Yeah, but you gotta look on the positive side," Lula said. "You don't have to worry about charging up the battery."
Lula's comment might have seemed casual considering the gravity of the situation, but truth is, this wasn't the first time someone had exploded my car. My cell phone rang, and I knew from the ringtone it was Ranger.
"You're off the grid,"
Ranger said when I answered. "Someone blew up my car." There was a moment of silence.
"And?"
"I guess I could use a ride."
"Babe,"
Ranger said, and he disconnected.
"He coming for us?"
Lula asked.
"Yep."
Ranger is Latino and former Special Forces turned semi-legitimate businessman. He's part owner of a security firm located in an inconspicuous 7-story building in the center of the city. I work for him on occasion. I've had one or two romantic skirmishes with him, and he has the sometimes annoying, sometimes convenient habit of installing tracking devices on my vehicles. His hair is dark brown and currently cut short. His eyes are mostly black. His body is perfect from the tip of his toes to the top of his head. He plays by his own rules, and his attitude is uncompromising. He only wears black, and he only drives black cars. He's smart. He's strong in every possible way, and being in his crosshairs is flat-out scary. No one came out of the little grocery store to look at the fire. No police cars or fire trucks screeched to the scene. It was as if this was business as usual and best ignored. I looked down the street at the rooming house, wondering if Melvin Barrow was in there melting down in a pool of sweat. No air conditioner sticking out of any of the windows in the rooming house. For sure, no central air.
"I bet that skinny guy you almost killed was running away from someone, and that's why he wanted your car," Lula said.
I leaned against the building. It was a bad choice of cars.
"Yeah, but he didn't know that. All he saw was two women sitting in a car like a couple dummies. He probably figured if we was stupid enough to be sitting in the car, we was stupid enough to give it over to him."
"He was wrong."
"Not by much," Lula said.
15 minutes later, Ranger eased his black Porsche Cayenne to a stop in front of Lula and me. I got into the front passenger seat, and Lula got into the back.
Ranger glanced at the charred cadaver of twisted metal and smoldering tires that used to be my car.
Yours?
He asked me.
Yep, I said. Do I need to know how this happened?
Nope. Ranger idled in front of the bonds office, and Lula got out. I moved to follow Lula, and Ranger wrapped his hand around my wrist.
Stay, I want to talk to you.
I am not currently in a physical relationship with Ranger. Ranger has clear priorities, and matrimony isn't high on the list. In fact, it isn't on the list at all. Until recently, marriage hasn't been high on my priorities list either, but my mother feels otherwise, and as much as I hate to admit it, my mother is wearing me down.
I need a date, Ranger said.
My voice ratcheted up an octave. You want me to get you a date?
No, I want you to be my date. I have to attend a black tie event, and I need someone watching my back.
Me? I wasn't exactly the Terminator.
People would talk if I brought Tank.
Tank is appropriately named. He's Ranger's shadow and second-in-command at Rangeman. And Ranger was right. Tank would make a controversial date. When is this? I asked Ranger.
Tomorrow night.
Tomorrow? I can't just drop everything and do this tomorrow. You should have asked me sooner. I'm seeing Morelli. It's Friday date night. We're going to the movies, and then...
I can give you a better, and then, Ranger said.
I went breathless for a beat at the thought of Ranger's, and then... Morelli was an amazing lover, but Ranger was magic. I pulled myself together and narrowed my eyes at Ranger, hoping I looked determined. You and I are done doing and then with each other, I said. There is absolutely no more and then. Morelli and I have an understanding.
Which is?
It's vague.
Babe.
I'm serious this time. I might be ready to have a committed adult relationship. Joe Morelli is a Trenton cop working plainclothes, crimes against persons. I've known him forever, and our relationship has progressed from downright hostile to deliciously hot to maybe we could actually live with each other without complete mayhem. He's 6 feet of hard muscle and Italian libido. His hair is black and wavy. His eyes are brown and assessing. His style is casual. He wears jeans, untucked shirts, and a Glock 19, and he is a big, shaggy dog named Bob.
I'll pay you, Ranger said.
Excuse me?
I'll hire you for the night. You can be my bodyguard.
At the risk of sounding mercenary, this got my attention. I was a month behind on my rent, and I wasn't having great luck with the fugitive apprehension stuff. Vinny had mostly low bond skips this month, and I was barely making pizza money, much less rent money. And I was pretty sure I could muster enough self-control to keep from ripping Ranger's clothes off. What exactly would bodyguarding entail? I asked him.
The usual. You take a bullet for me if necessary, and you manage the small talk.
You can't manage your own small talk?
Making polite conversation isn't at the top of my skill set.
I've noticed. Okay, so this doesn't sound so bad. Plus, I get dinner, right? What time will you pick me up?
6 o'clock. This event is in Atlantic City. Dinner is at 8.
Chapter 2. I left Ranger and joined Lula in the bonds office. The building was brand new and light years better than the old office. It had been built on the same footprint as the old office, but the walls were freshly painted, the tile on the floor was unscuffed, the furniture was inexpensive but comfortable and free from food and coffee stains. Lula had claimed her usual spot on the faux leather couch, and Connie, the office manager, was at her desk. Connie is a couple years older than me, a much better shot, and better connected. Connie's family is old-school Italian mob, and far more professional than Trenton's gangsta morons when it comes to crime-related skills such as whacking, hijacking, and money laundering. Connie looks a lot like Betty Boop, with big hair and a mustache. Today she was wearing a short black pencil skirt, a wide black patent leather belt, and a tight red sweater with a low scoop neck that showed a lot of her Betty Boopness. I looked over at the closed door behind Connie that led to my cousin Vinny's private office. Is Vinny in? I asked her. Connie looked up from her computer. No, he's downtown bonding out Jimmy Pulowski.
Pulaski's neighbor caught him watering her flowers without a watering can, if you get what I mean. He got arrested for drunken disorderly and indecent exposure. I sunk into the molded plastic office chair in front of Connie's desk. My car got blown up. I heard, same old, same old. I need money. Anything good come in? Do you remember Jeffrey Cubbin? Yeah, he was arrested last month for embezzling $5 million from Cranberry Manor. Connie handed me a file. The judge set a really high bond and Vinny signed on the dotted line. Cubbin didn't seem like much of a risk. No prior arrests and he was claiming he was innocent. Plus, he had a wife and a cat. Men with cats are usually good risks, very stable. And he's gone, disappeared off the face of the earth along with the $5 million. There's an article in the paper this morning. He was at home awaiting his trial. He woke up in the middle of the night with pain and fever and went to the ER, and 4 hours later he was minus his appendix. That was 3 days ago. When his wife arrived at the hospital yesterday to take him home, he was gone, vanished. No one saw him leave. Is this our problem? It'll officially be our problem on Monday. If he doesn't show up for court, we'll forfeit the bond. Personally, I think it sounds like he skipped. His court date was right around the corner, and he panicked. If he'd gotten convicted, he'd be looking at a good chunk of prison time. You might want to poke around before the trail gets cold. I took the file and leafed through it. Jeffrey Cubbin was 42 years old, Wharton Business School graduate, managed the Cranberry Manor assisted living facility. I studied his photo. Pleasant-looking guy, brown hair, glasses, no tattoos or piercings noted. His height was listed at 5'10". Average weight plus a few extra pounds. He had a wife and a cat. No kids. The hospital was the logical place to start. It was also the closest. Cubbin lived in Hamilton Township, and Cranberry Manor was a 35 to 40-minute drive when traffic was heavy in downtown Trenton.
No, Lula said.
No what? I asked her.
No, I'm not going to the hospital with you. I saw that look on your face, and I know you figured you'd start by going to the hospital. And I'm not going, on account of I don't like hospitals. They smell funny, and they're filled with sick people. Last time I was in a hospital, it was depressing, and I think I might have picked up a fungus. Lucky for me, I got a high resistance to that sort of thing, and it was one of them 24-hour funguses.
St. Francis Hospital is about a half mile down Hamilton Avenue from the Bonds office. It's on the opposite side of the street from the Bonds office, so it's officially in the Burg. The Burg is a close-knit, blue-collar residential chunk of South Trenton that runs on gossip, good Catholic guilt, and pot roast at 6 o'clock. It's bordered by Chambers Street, Hamilton Avenue, Broad Street, and Liberty Street. I grew up in the Burg, and my parents still live there in a small two-family house on High Street. Not a problem, I said. I can walk to St. Francis.
He wasn't at St. Francis, Connie said. He went to Central Hospital on Joy Street.
You're never going to walk there, Lula said. That's way off Greenwood.
Drive me to the hospital, I said to Lula. You can wait in the lobby.
I'll drive you to the hospital, Lula said, but I'm not waiting in no lobby. I'll wait in my car.
Central Hospital had been built in the 40s and looked more like a factory than a hospital. Dark red brick. 5 floors of grim little rooms where patients were warehoused. A small drive court for the ER. A double door in the front of the building. The double door opened onto a lobby with a standard-issue information desk, brown leather couches, and 2 fake trees. I'd never been in the OR, but I imagined it as being medieval. The hospital didn't have a wonderful reputation.
Huh, Lula said, pulling into the parking garage. I suppose I'm going to have to go with you. If you don't have me watching out for shit, you're liable not to come out. That's how hospitals get you. You go in to visit, and before you know it, they got a camera stuck up your butt, and they're looking to find polo ponies.
Do you mean polyps?
Yeah. Isn't that what I said? Anyway, my Uncle Andy had that done, and they said he had them polyps, and next thing they took his intestines out, and he had to poop in a bag. So I'm here to tell you there's no way I'm pooping in a bag.
I'm not crazy about this conversation, I said. Could we move on to something else? Lula parked her red Firebird on the second level and cut the engine.
I'm just saying.
We entered the hospital through the front door, and I approached the woman at the desk. I'm investigating the Cubbin disappearance, I said to the woman. I'd like to speak to your head of security.
Do you have ID? She asked.
Here's the deal about doing fugitive apprehension for a bail bondsman. I have all sorts of rights to apprehend because the bondee has signed them over, but I'm not a police officer. Fortunately, most people aren't clear on the technicalities, and most people don't look too closely at my ID. Truth is, I bought my badge and my laminated ID on the internet. $7.95 plus postage. They look pretty genuine. Not that I'm lying or anything. They say bond enforcement agent, and they have my name on them. Not my problem if people confuse me with a cop, right? I flashed her my badge and my ID. Her phone rang, and she moved me along.
First floor, she said. Room 117. Down the corridor to the right. If no one's there, you can page him on the intercom at the door.
I mouthed thank you, and Lula and I went in search of room 117.
I've only been here a minute, and already I can feel myself getting hospital cooties, Lula said. I itch all over. I got the hospital heebie-jeebies.
The door to room 117 was closed. I knocked, and someone inside grunted acknowledgement. I opened the door and was surprised to find Randy Briggs in a tan and blue security guard uniform. I've crossed paths with Randy Briggs on several occasions, and some have been more pleasant than others. Briggs is single, in his early 40s, has a small amount of sandy blonde hair, and a narrow face with close-set eyes. He's 3 feet tall, and he has the personality of a rabid raccoon.
Whoa, I said. What's with the uniform?
What's it look like? Briggs said. I'm head of security.
You were always a tech guy, I said. What happened to the computer programming?
No jobs. The shit's made in China, and the tech support comes from Sri Lanka. The only reason I got this job is because they were afraid I'd pull a dwarf discrimination suit.
They let you have a gun? Lula asked.
Yeah, Briggs said. I'm real good at shooting guys in the nuts, being there at eye level.
It was a small office furnished with a desk and some uncomfortable-looking chairs. There was a dinosaur computer, a phone, a stack of files in manila folders, and a couple walkie-talkies. There were a bunch of handwritten notes and several photographs tacked to a bulletin board behind the desk. It looked to me like one of the photographs was of Jeffrey Cubbin. Are those the ones who got away? I asked Briggs.
That's what they tell me. I haven't been on the job that long. I've only had one go south on my watch.
Jeffrey Cubbin?
Yep. The night nurse checked him at 2 a.m. and reported him sleeping. The next entry on his chart was at 6 a.m. and he was gone, along with his clothes and personal effects.
Is that what his chart says? I asked Briggs.
No, that's what the paper said. Jesus, don't you read the paper?
So how's this dude manage to walk out of here if he just had his appendix yanked out? Lula asked. That gotta hurt. Maybe it was that he died and got rolled down to the meat locker and no one thought to look there. Oh no, wait a minute. He wouldn't have gotten dressed to die.
Cubbin was looking at about 10 years of eating prison food and stamping out license plates, Briggs said. You could get past a little pain to walk away from that.
I'd like to talk to his doctor and the night nurse, I said to Briggs. Do you have their names?
No, and I'm not getting them for you either. I'm here to uphold hospital confidentiality. I'm the top cop.
Looks to me like you're the bottom half of the top cop, Lula said.
Briggs cut his eyes to Lula.
Looks to me like you're fat enough to be a whole police force.
You watch your mouth, Lula said. I could sit on you and squash you like a bug. Be nothing left of you but a grease spot on the floor.
There'll be no squashing, I said to Lula. And you, I said to Briggs, pointing my finger at him, you need to get a grip. I whirled around and swished out of Briggs's office with Lula close on my heels. I returned to the lobby and called Connie. Do we know who operated on Cubbin? I asked her. I want to talk to the doctor.
Hang tight. I'll make some phone calls.
Lula and I browsed through the gift shop, took a turn around the lobby, and Connie called back.
The doctor's name is Craig Fish, Connie said. I got his name from your grandmother. She's plugged into the Metamucil Medicare gossip hotline. He's a general surgeon in private practice with privileges at St. Francis and Central. His office is in the Medical Arts Building 2 blocks from Central. He's married with 2 kids in college, one in California and the other in Texas. No litigation against him. No derogatory information on file.
We drove to the Medical Arts Building, and Lula dropped me off at the door.
There's a Dunkin' Donuts shop in that gas station on the corner, she said. I might have to get some donuts on account of I feel weak after being in the hospital and getting the cooties and all.
I thought you were trying to lose weight.
Yeah, but this could be an emergency situation. The cooties might have eaten up all my sugar, and I need to shovel some more in.
That's so lame, I said to her. Why don't you just admit you want donuts and you have no willpower?
Yeah, but that don't sound as good. You want any donuts?
Give me a Boston cream. I took the elevator to the fourth floor and found Fish's office. There were two people in the waiting room, a man and a woman. Neither of them looked happy, probably contemplating having something essential removed from their bodies in the near future. I flashed my credentials at the receptionist and told her I'd like to have a moment with the doctor.
Of course, she said. He's with the patient right now, but I'll let him know you're here.
10 minutes and 3 dog-eared magazines later, I was ushered into Fish's small, cluttered office.
I only have a few minutes, he said. How can I help you?
Craig Fish was a bland man in his mid-50s. He had steel-gray hair, a round, cherubic face, and his blue and white striped dress shirt was stretched tight across his belly. He wasn't fat, but he wasn't fit either. He had some family photos on his desk, his 2 kids on a beach somewhere, smiling at the camera, and a picture of himself getting cozy with a blonde woman who looked on the short side of 30. She was spilling out of her slinky dress, and she had a diamond the size of Rhode Island on her finger. I assumed this was his latest wife. Did Jeffrey Cubbin give any indication he intended to leave early? I asked him.
No, he didn't seem unusually anxious. The operation was routine, and his post-op was normal.
Do you have any idea where he might be?
Usually when patients leave prior to discharge, they go home.
Apparently that wasn't the case this time. Does this happen a lot?
Not a lot, but more often than you think. People get homesick, dissatisfied with care, worried about expenses, and sometimes it's the result of a drug reaction and the patient isn't thinking clearly.
Has Cubbin made an appointment for a recheck?
You'd have to ask my receptionist about that. I only see my patient list for the current day.
His intercom buzzed, and his receptionist reminded him Mrs. Weinstein was in examining room 3. I stopped at the desk on the way out and asked if Jeffrey Cubbin had scheduled a post-op appointment. I was told he had not. Lula was idling at the curb when I left the medical building. I buckled myself in next to her and looked into the Dunkin' Donuts box on the floor. It was empty.
"Where's my donut?" I asked her.
"Oops, I guess I ate it."
Lucky me. Better on Lula's thighs than on mine, especially since I was going to have to squeeze into a cocktail dress tomorrow night.
"Now what?" Lula asked. "Are we done for the day? I'm not feeling so good after all those donuts. I was only going to eat 2, but then I lost track of what I was doing, and next thing, there weren't any more donuts. It was like I blacked out and someone came and ate the donuts."
"You have powdered sugar and jelly stains on your tank top."
"Huh," Lula said, looking down at herself. "Guess I was the one ate them."
"It would be great if you could drive me to my parents' house so I can borrow Big Blue." Big Blue is a 53 powder blue and white Buick that got deposited in my father's garage when my great-uncle Sandor checked himself into Happy Hills Nursing Home. It drives like a refrigerator on wheels, and it does nothing for my image. Only Jay Leno could look good driving this car. In its favor, it's free. Chapter 3. My parents live in a small mustard yellow and brown 2-story house that shares a wall with an identical house that is painted lime green. I suppose the 2-family house seemed like an economical idea 40 years ago at the time of construction, and there are many of them in the burg. Siamese twins conjoined at the living room downstairs and master bedroom upstairs with separate brains. The house has a postage-stamp front yard, a small front porch, and a long, narrow backyard. The floor plan is shotgun. Living room, dining room, kitchen. 3 small bedrooms and a bathroom upstairs. My Grandma Mazur lives with my parents. She moved in when my Grandpa Mazur's arteries totally clogged with pork fat, and he got a 1-way ticket to God's big pig roast in the sky. Grandma was at the front door when Lula eased the Firebird to a stop at the curb. I used to think Grandma had a telepathic way of knowing when I approached, but I now realized Grandma just stands at the door watching the cars roll by like the street is a reality show. Her face lit, and she waved as we drove up.
"I like your granny," Lula said. "She always looked like she's happy to see us. That's not something that happens every day. Half the time we knock on a door and people shoot at us.
Yes, but that's only half the time. Sometimes they just run away. See you tomorrow.
Tomorrow, Kimasabi.
How's business? Grandma asked when I got to the door. Did you catch anyone today? Where's your car?
My car got blown up.
Again? How many does that make this month?
It's the only one this month. I was hoping I could borrow Big Blue.
Sure, you can borrow it whenever you want. I don't drive it on account of it. Don't make me look hot.
I suppose everything's relative, but I thought it would take more than a fast car to make Grandma look hot. Gravity hasn't been kind to Grandma. She also doesn't have a license due to a heavy foot on the accelerator. Still, I suspected lack of license wouldn't stop her if she had access to a Ferrari. I heard a car door slam and turned to see Lula coming toward us.
I smell fried chicken, Lula said.
Grandma waved her in.
Stephanie's mother is frying some up for dinner, and we got a chocolate cake for dessert. We got plenty if you want to stay.
A half hour later, Lula and I were at the dining room table eating the fried chicken with my mom, Dad, and Grandma Mazur.
Stephanie blew up another car, Grandma Mazur announced, spooning out mashed potatoes.
Technically, some gang guy blew it up, Lula said, and the car wasn't worth much. The battery was dead.
My mother made the sign of the cross and belted back half a glass of what looked like iced tea but smelled a lot like Jim Beam. My father kept his head down and gnawed on a chicken leg.
I wasn't in it, I said. It was an accident.
I don't understand how you have all these accidents, my mother said. I don't know of a single other person who's had his car blown up.
She looked down the table at my father.
Frank, do you know of anyone else who's ever had their car blown up? Frank, are you listening to me?
My father picked his head up and a piece of chicken fell out of his mouth.
What? It's our job, Lula said. It's one of them occupational hazards. Like another hazard is getting hospital cooties. We had to do some investigating in a hospital today, and I might have got the cooties.
I bet you were tracking down Jeffrey Cubbin, Grandma said. Connie called me asking about his doctor. I know something about it on account of Lorraine Mucci has a relative in Cranberry Manor, and Lorraine said Cubbin is going to need a lot of doctors if those people get their hands on him.
What else did Lorraine say about him? I asked Grandma.
She said he seemed like a real nice man, and the next thing, he stole all the money. Cranberry Manor's one of them places you buy into, and it isn't cheap. Cranberry Manor's top of the line, considering it's in Jersey. Lorraine says it could close down, and her relative would have her keister tossed out onto the street.
Sounds like she's boned, Lula said.
Boned?
My mother asked.
Grandma selected another piece of chicken. That's a polite way of using the F word.
My mother cut her eyes to the kitchen, and I knew she was thinking about refilling her iced tea. Grandma and I are a trial to her. My mother tries hard to be a good Christian woman and a model of decorum, but Grandma and I, not so much. It isn't that we don't want to be decorous Christian women. It's just that it doesn't always go that way.
Vinny bonded Jeffrey Cubbin out, Lula said, and now we gotta find him.
It's a real interesting case, Grandma said. He just up and got dressed in the middle of the night and walked out. If you ask me, it's fishy. And I know his doctor is named Fish, but I don't mean that way. Cubbin had stitches and everything. You don't go jogging down the hall and hailing a cab 2 days after you get your appendix cut out. You creep around, hunched over, doing a lot of moaning and complaining.
So what do you think happened to him? Lula asked.
I don't know, but seems to me he had to have help, Grandma said.
That's what I think, too. And why didn't anyone see him standing waiting for the elevator? Lula asked.
Budget cuts, Grandma said. They hardly got any nurses working. And used to be they had cameras in the elevators, but I hear they go on the fritz all the time. I tell you, hospitals aren't what they used to be. Myra and I go to Central for lunch once a week, but the food's gotten terrible lately, and people are turning surly.
You must know a lot of sick people, Lula said.
We don't go to visit sick people, Grandma said. We just go for lunch. They always have a big buffet in the cafeteria, and it's cheap because that's where the people who work at the hospital eat. Everybody's wearing those scrub clothes. It's just like being in Grey's Anatomy. All the seniors eat there, and sometimes you can score a date. I met a real hottie there last month, but he had an aneurysm and died before I could haul him in. And then after lunch, we go to the Costco and get desserts from the free sample ladies. I love those ladies, Lula said. At the end of the month, if Myra and me run out of Social Security, we skip the hospital and just have lunch from the free sample ladies, Grandma said.
Honestly, my mother said, you make it sound like I don't feed you. There's always food here for lunch.
I like to eat out once in a while, Grandma said. Gives me a reason to put lipstick on. And there's always a lot of drama at the hospital. I got the dirt on all the nurses. You just gotta sit by the right people and keep your ears open.
We should put you on a case, Lula said to Grandma. We went to the hospital and we couldn't find out nothing.
You tell me what you're looking for and I'll find it, Grandma said. I'm real nosy and I've been thinking about turning professional.
That would be an excellent plan, Lula said. We wouldn't have to go back to Central if you were there. We could spend our time doing other important stuff that's not in a hospital.
It's not an excellent plan, my mother said. It's an awful plan. Isn't it enough she causes havoc in every funeral home in a 20-mile radius?
Not always, Grandma said. I just don't like when they have a closed casket. I think it's a gyp. How do you know if there's anyone in there?
My mother shook her fork at me. I'm holding you responsible. If your grandmother gets arrested for disturbing the peace in that hospital, you can kiss chocolate cake goodbye for the rest of your life. Pineapple upside-down cake, too.
Boy, that's hardball, Lula said.
I wouldn't want you to do without pineapple upside-down cake, Grandma said. I guess I shouldn't snoop for you. I gotta go to the hairdresser anyway. There's gonna be a big viewing tomorrow night for Stanley Kuberski, and I want to look good. The paper said the Elks will be holding a ceremony for him, and there's a couple hot Elks I got my eye on.
You should go with your grandmother, my mother said. Loretta Gross's boy Cameron is an Elk. I bet he'll be there, and he just got a divorce.
Is he hot? Grandma asked. I might be interested in him.
He's too young for you, my mother said. My father shoveled in potatoes.
Everyone is too young for her.
I'm aiming for young, Grandma said. When I go out with someone old, they die before I can reel them in. Besides, I've been told I don't look my age.
It's true that Grandma doesn't look her age. She looks about 90. It was a little after 8 o'clock when Lula and I left my parents' house. Lula drove off in her red Firebird, and I drove off in Big Blue. I had a bag of leftovers on the seat beside me, and I was at a crossroads. I could take the leftovers home, or I could drive the short distance to Morelli's house and share. Sharing seemed like the way to go since I was going to beg off our Friday night date. Joe Morelli inherited a house from his Aunt Rose. It's just outside the Berg boundary, on a quiet street in a blue-collar neighborhood much like the Berg. It's a small two-story row house that is a comfortable mix of Morelli and his aunt. Her old-fashioned curtains still hang on the windows, but most of the furniture belongs to Morelli and his shaggy, red-haired dog, Bob. Bob is part Golden Retriever and part Wookiee. He eats everything, loves everyone, and mellows out Morelli. I parked in front of Morelli's house, went to the door, and let myself in. Hey, I yelled, I've got food. Anybody home? Bob gave a woof from the kitchen at the back of the house, and I heard him gallop toward me. He came at me full speed, put his front paws on my chest, and knocked me flat on my back. He ripped the food bag out of my hand and galloped off. Morelli sauntered over from the living room and helped me up.
Are you okay?
I was bringing you fried chicken, but Bob knocked me down and took the bag of food.
Damn, Morelli said. You can't have chicken bones. He hacks them up in the middle of the night.
Morelli left me to track down Bob. There was a lot of yelling and growling from the vicinity of the kitchen, and Morelli returned to the living room with the bag of food, a fork, and two beers. He wrapped an arm around my neck, pulled me into him, and kissed me.
The Mets are up by 2 runs, he said. What's going on with you?
I sat next to him on the couch and took a beer. I had to borrow Big Blue, so I had dinner with my parents.
Something wrong with your car?
It accidentally got blown up. Morelli turned and focused on me.
Car bomb?
Handheld rocket. The line of his mouth tightened a little, and his eyes narrowed ever so slightly.
It was an accident?
I was on Stark Street.
That explains it,
Morelli said, his attention back to the bag of food. He ate the chocolate cake first. He gave some potatoes to Bob, and he put the rest in the fridge for later.
This is a nice surprise, he said, settling back into the couch. Do you want to take your clothes off?
Whatever happened to romance? What about foreplay?
Foreplay goes faster without clothes.
Fast is important. Morelli flicked his eyes back to the television.
They're changing the picture. We probably have 10 minutes.
I need more than 10 minutes. Morelli grinned at me, and his eyes got soft and dark.
I know.
And I get distracted by television.
He remoted the television off.
Yeah, I know that, too.
What happens after 10 minutes and the new picture's ready to go?
Fireworks. And then you tell me I'm amazing.
Suppose there aren't fireworks after 10 minutes.
I'm no quitter,
Morelli said. I knew this to be true. I think I'm getting in the mood, I said to him, and I can see you're already a couple steps ahead of me.
You noticed.
Hard not to. He nuzzled my neck, popped a snap at the top of my jeans, and slid the zipper down.
Let me help you catch up.
Chapter 4 Morelli is always fully awake at the crack of dawn, ready to go out and enforce the law, or, if I'm in his bed, to grab a quickie while I'm still half asleep. I opened an eye and saw that he was moving around in the dimly lit room. He was clean-shaven, his hair was still damp from his shower, and he was dressed in slacks and a blue dress shirt. "Is this dress up Friday?" I asked him.
"I have court."
He took his watch off the nightstand and slipped it on.
"I'll probably be there most of the morning."
I looked under the covers. I was naked. "Did we have sex this morning?"
"Yeah, you thanked me after and said it was great."
"You're fibbing. I never thank you." I got out of bed and dropped one of Morelli's t-shirts over my head. I shuffled after him down the stairs and into the kitchen. Morelli's kitchen is small but cozy. He's laid new tile on the floor, put in a new countertop, and repainted the cabinets and walls. His appliances aren't new, but they're newer than mine. His refrigerator is usually filled with food. His cereal doesn't have bugs in it, and he has a toaster. This all puts him light years ahead of me in the domestic goddess race. A door opens off the kitchen onto Morelli's narrow backyard. He's had it fenced in for Bob, and Bob was impatiently waiting to get let out to tinkle. Morelli opened the door, and Bob bolted out into the darkness.
"You never get up this early," Morelli said, closing the door, pushing the brew button on the coffee maker. "What's going on?"
"I was hoping you knew something about Jeffrey Cubbin."
"The guy who disappeared from Central Hospital? I don't know much. It's not my case."
"How could someone just walk away in the middle of the night without anyone seeing him?"
"I'm told it happens," Morelli said. "And he had good reason to want to walk away. He didn't have a promising future."
"Who has the case?"
"Lenny Schmidt."
"Did he check to see if Cubbin called a cab?" Morelli did a palms up. He didn't know.
"I assume you're looking for Cubbin because Vinny wrote the bond."
I dropped two slices of bread into the toaster. "It's a high bond, and I could use the money. I need a new car."
"You always need a new car. What you really need is a new job."
I got two mugs out of his over-the-counter cabinet and put them on the little kitchen dining table. "Which brings me to the other issue. I'm going to have to cancel our date tonight. I told Ranger I'd do security for him at a party. He needed a woman."
"I bet,"
Morelli said. "It's security at a party."
"I don't like you working with him. He's not normal, and he looks at you like you're lunch."
"You look at me like that, too."
"Cupcake, you are my lunch."
Morelli filled the mugs with coffee and spread strawberry jelly on his piece of toast.
"Call me if you get done with the party early. If I run into Schmidt, I'll ask about the cab, but I doubt Schmidt's done much to find Cubbin. Schmidt's got a full caseload, and at this point, Cubbin is more your problem than his."
He looked at the black t-shirt I was wearing. It hung about 6 inches below my doodah.
"Do you have anything under that shirt?"
"You could peek and find out."
"Tempting, but I'm late for my morning meeting."
"Then I guess you'll never know." Morelli lifted the hem of the shirt, looked under, and smiled.
"I'm in love."
"What about your meeting?"
"I might make some of it if I use my flashers and run the lights."
Connie and Lula were already at the office when I rolled in. The door to Vinny's lair was open, and I could smell cigar smoke.
"Is that her?" Vinny yelled.
There was a sound of a chair scraping back, and Vinny charged out, the cigar clamped between his teeth. Vinny is slightly taller than me and looks like a weasel. His dark hair is slicked back, his eyes are crafty, his pants are too tight, and his shoes are too pointy. He has an affinity for pain inflicted by women wielding cuffs and paddles, and he's been rumored to enjoy intimate relationships with barnyard animals.
He's married to a perfectly nice woman named Lucille, who, for reasons I'll never understand, has chosen to endure the marriage. And last but not least, probably because he's such a loser himself, Vincent Plum has a good understanding of the criminal mind, and that makes him an excellent bail bondsman.
"Where is he?"
Vinny asked me. "Where's who?"
"That asshole Cubbin. Who else? You got him nailed down, right?"
"Not exactly." Vinny had his hands in the air.
"What, not exactly? What does that mean?"
"It means I don't know where he is."
"You're killing me," Vinny said. "If this agency tanks, it's all your fault. It's on your head. Fatso over there will have to go back to the streets, and Connie will be doing wet work."
"Excuse me," Lula said. "Fatso? Did I hear you call me Fatso? Because you better tell me I heard wrong, on account of I might have to beat the crap out of you if I heard right."
Vinny clamped down tighter on his cigar and growled.
"Just find him," he said to me,
and he retreated into his office and slammed the door shut.
"Get a grip," I yelled at him. "He's not even officially FTA until Monday."
"We've got donuts," Connie said, pointing to a box on her desk. "Help yourself."
"I'm going to talk to Cubbin's wife," I said to Connie, "and then I'm going to take a look at the nursing home. Maybe you could make some phone calls for me and find out if he took a cab somewhere when he checked out of the hospital."
Lula was on her feet, her head swiveled around trying to check out her ass.
"That's a second person told me I was fat this week. I don't feel fat. I just feel like I got a lot of all the good stuff. What do you think?"
she asked Connie and me. "Do you think I'm fat?"
"Well, you're not thin," Connie said.
"Some of me's thin," Lula said. "I got thin legs. I got Angelina Jolie ankles."
Connie and I looked at her ankles. Not fat. Possibly Angelina quality.
"It's just between my armpits and my hoo-ha that I'm better than most ladies," Lula said. "I got stuff a man could hang on to. That's one of the reasons I was so good as a hoe."
"As long as you're healthy," I said to her. "You're healthy, right?"
"Yeah, I feel great. And one of these days I'm going to go get myself checked out to take a look at my cholesterol, my sugar, and my blood pressure."
Connie took the box of donuts off her desk and threw it into her wastebasket.
"So now what?" Lula asked. "We going to see Mrs. Cubbin?"
I had Cubbin's file open to his bond sheet. He looked worried in the photo, or maybe he was squinting in the sun. "He lives in Hamilton Township by the high school," I said.
"We could sneak around and look in his windows and see if he's hanging out in his undies watching television and popping painkillers," Lula said.
20 minutes later, Lula and I pulled up to Cubbin's house. It was a modest white ranch with black shutters and a forest green front door. A white Camry was parked in the driveway leading to the attached garage. Very middle America.
"Which one of us is going to do the sneaking around and which one the doorbell ringing?" Lula asked.
"I'm ringing the doorbell," I told her. "You can do whatever you want." I walked to the small front porch, rang the bell, and Lula skirted the side of the house. The front door opened, and a woman looked out at me.
"What?" she said.
She had fried blonde hair, an extra 40 pounds on her small frame, a cigarette hanging out of the corner of her mouth, and a spray tan that had turned a toxic shade of orange. "Mrs. Susan Cubbin?"
"Unfortunately."
"You don't like being Mrs. Cubbin?"
"For 8 years I've been married to a man with a 2-inch penis and one nut. The loser finally grows balls and steals $5 million, and I can't get my hands on it."
She took a long pull on her cigarette and squinted at me through the smoke haze.
"And?"
I introduced myself, showed her my semi-fake badge, and gave her my card.
"Bounty hunter," she said. "So I'm gonna help you. Why?"
"For starters, this house was put up as insurance against the bond."
"Like I care. It's got mold in the basement, the roof's fallen apart, and the water heater is leaking. The mortgage is killing me, and the bank won't take it back. I can't even get this disaster foreclosed. I don't want the house. I want the friggin' money. I want to get my stomach stapled."
"Have you seen your husband or heard from him since he left the hospital?"
"No. He didn't even have the decency to tell me not to come pick him up to go home."
"Has anyone heard from him?"
"Not that I know about."
"Did he withdraw any money from your bank account?"
"Do I look like someone who has money in the bank?"
"Most people who skip at least take clothes, but your husband disappeared with just the clothes he wore when he checked into the hospital."
"He's got $5 million stashed somewhere. The jerk can buy new clothes."
Do you have any idea where he might have gone?
If I knew where he went, I'd be there, and I'd choke him until he coughed up the money.
Cranberry Manor would be grateful.
I don't give a fig about Cranberry Manor, Susan said. Those people are old. They're gonna die. I want the money.
A police car angled to a stop behind Lula's Firebird, and two guys got out. One was sort of a friend of mine, Carl Costanza. We'd done communion together, among other things. Costanza and his partner stood hands on their gun belts, looking at Lula's Firebird, then looking at me, sizing up the situation. I gave them a little wave, and they walked over.
We got a report from a neighbor that a woman was acting suspiciously creeping around this house, Carl said.
That might be Lula, I told him.
Who's Lula?
Susan Cubbin asked. She's my partner, I said.
And why is she creeping around my house?
She thought she saw a cat, and she's a real cat lover.
Oh, geez, Susan said. Don't tell me my cat got out again.
It could always be some other cat, I said.
I gotta make sure. What color was it? Where's your partner?
Hey, Lula, I yelled. Lula poked her head around the side of the house.
You call me.
What color cat did you see?
Say what?
You know, the cat you went to find when you were walking around the house just now. What color was it?
White, Lula said.
Thank goodness, Susan said. My Fluffy is orange.
Case closed, Carl said.
I'd appreciate it if you'd let me know if you hear from your husband, I said to Susan.
Yeah, Susan said. Likewise.
We followed Carl and his partner to the curb.
Was he in there? Carl asked Lula. Not that I could see, Lula said. You're talking about the white cat, right?
Right, Carl said. We all got into our cars and drove away.
Now what? Lula wanted to know.
Now we visit Cranberry Manor. Did you see anything unusual when you were snooping?
I didn't see any sign of Jeffrey Cubbin, but someone had been packing a suitcase.
Men's clothes or women's clothes?
Look like women's clothes.
My cell phone rang, and Grandma's number came up.
I'm at the beauty parlor, and I need a ride, Grandma said.
Where are you going?
To the hospital, of course. I'm on the job. I just made that baloney up about the beauty parlor to get out of the house. I figured if your mother knew I was going to the hospital, she'd head for the liquor cabinet.
We'll be in big trouble if she finds out I took you to the hospital.
She won't find out. I'm wearing a disguise, and I have a fake ID. As far as anyone knows, I'm Selma Wizard today.
What's going on? Lula wanted to know.
It's Grandma. She's at the beauty parlor, and she needs a ride to the hospital so she can snoop for us. She said she's in disguise.
I gotta see this. Is she at the beauty parlor on Hamilton by the bridal shop?
Yes.
I'm on it. Tell her we're 15 minutes out.
Chapter 5 Lula almost jumped the curb when she saw Grandma in front of the hair salon. Grandma was wearing a blonde Marilyn Monroe wig, a hot pink tank top, black Pilates pants, and black kitten heels. She looked like the senior version of an inflatable sex toy doll that needed more air.
Your granny's real fashion-forward with a retro wig, and I love the little pink tank top, Lula said. But we gotta fatten her up. I don't like to be critical, only she's got too much skin. You could fit a whole other person in that skin.
Grandma tottered over on her little heels.
What do you think? Grandma said, climbing into the back seat. I bet you didn't know who it was standing there until I waved at you.
It's a good disguise, Lula said, but you might be cold in that tank top when you get into the hospital.
I got a sweater in my purse, Grandma said. I'm all prepared. I could take care of any situation. I'm packing heat more ways than one.
Lula pulled out into traffic.
You telling me you got a gun?
Of course I got a gun. I got a big one, too. A person's got to be prepared. You never know when you might have to stop a bank robbery.
That's true, Lula said. Good thinking.
It's not good thinking, I said. Grandma clicked her seatbelt into place.
You sound like your mother.
Sometimes she's right. Truth is, she was almost always right. And my life would probably be improved if I listened to her more often.
What are you girls doing today? Grandma asked.
We're going to check out Cranberry Manor, Lula said. It's one of them exploratory trips.
Maybe I could go with you, Grandma said. I always wanted to see Cranberry Manor. I heard a lot about it. And then you could drop me off at the hospital on the way back.
That's not a bad idea, Lula said. Granny could be our decoy. We could go incognito.
Grandma sat forward. I could say I'm interested in moving there on account of my son-in-law as a horse's patoot.
And your mother wouldn't get so mad at you if she found out you took Granny to see about moving into the old people's home, Lula said.
A half hour later, we parked in the visitor's lot and entered Cranberry Manor through the front door. It was a typical senior living complex with a pleasant reception area and two wings for residents.
This is real pretty, Grandma said. They have flowers grown outside and everything looks fresh painted.
That's not going to last long, being that they're broke, Lula said.
We stopped at a small informal reception desk in the lobby and told the woman we'd like a tour.
I'm interested in living here, Grandma said. I want to see everything.
Wonderful, the woman said, taking in Grandma's hair and tank top, trying to maintain a friendly smile.
I'll ring Carol. She's our salesperson.
Carol appeared immediately, undoubtedly excited at the thought of extracting money from someone who might not have heard Cranberry Manor was filing for bankruptcy.
Just down the hall is the dining room, Carol said, leading the way.
I like the sound of that, Grandma said. Do they serve cocktails?
Not cocktails, but residents can have wine with dinner.
Grandma peeked inside the dining room.
Just like being at a fancy restaurant with tablecloths and everything. Can I have oatmeal and eggs and bacon at breakfast?
Yes.
And coffee cake?
Yes.
Sign me up, Grandma said.
We have more to see, I told her.
Yeah, don't get carried away with the oatmeal, Lula said.
We have two identical wings, Carol said. They each have their own social center.
The social center we visited looked like a big living room. Large screen television, three game tables, couches and chairs arranged in conversational groups. Four women were playing bridge at one of the game tables. Two men were watching a Wheel of Fortune rerun on the television.
Excuse me, Grandma said to the women. I might move here, and I was wondering what you thought of the place.
They use powdered eggs at breakfast, one of the women said. They tell us they're real eggs, but I know a powdered egg when I see one.
And they buy cheap toilet paper, another woman said, single ply, and it's all because of that Jeffrey Cubbon.
And he was a womanizer, the first woman said. He was having affairs with some of the ladies here.
You mean some of the ladies who live here? Grandma asked.
The woman nodded.
There have been rumors.
I wouldn't mind having an affair, Grandma said.
Good riddance to bad rubbish, the woman said. He's gone and he's not coming back.
The women all nodded in agreement.
You don't know that for sure, Grandma said. He could pop up.
He better not pop up here, the woman said. It wouldn't be healthy for him, if you know what I mean. We would have put a hit out on him, but he stole all our money.
Let's move on to the exercise area, Carol said, steering Grandma away.
Do you have any idea what happened to Jeffrey Cubbon? I asked Carol. I understand he had his appendix removed and then disappeared from the hospital.
I don't know anything about that, Carol said. I have my hands full here trying to keep the crew from mutiny.
We toured the rest of the building, talked to about 40 people, got a brochure and an application from Carol, and returned to the Firebird.
I could have my own bathroom if I lived here, Grandma said. That's on the plus side. On the other side, I wouldn't have anything to do at night. How would I get to the funeral home for viewings?
Yeah, and those Cranberry people were all cranky, Lula said. They should be giving them more than one glass of wine at dinner. They should be putting Kahlua in their coffee in the morning. And if they find Cubbon toes up in a dumpster, they should start the investigation at Cranberry Manor because he's not a popular guy there.
Lula drove us back to Trenton and dropped Grandma off at the hospital. Don't shoot anyone, I told Grandma.
Only if I have to, she said, straightening her wig. I'll call when I need a ride home.
I'm hungry, Lula said, driving off. I could use a healthy lunch like nachos from the convenience store on Olden.
That's not healthy.
It's corn and it's got cheese product. That's two of the major food groups.
If we wait until we get back to the office, we can stop at Giovicini's and get a salad.
A salad? What do I look like, an alpaca? I'm a big woman. I can't keep going on a salad. I need salt and grease and shit.
I had to get into a slinky little black dress tonight. I wasn't up for salt and grease and shit. Giovicini will add all that stuff to your salad. Just ask for it.
Yeah, but I'll have to pay extra.
I have no willpower. If Lula stops for nachos, I'll get them too. Or even worse, I'll get a couple hot dogs. My treat, I said.
That's different then. Here we go to Giovicini.
Giovicini's Deli and Meat Market is just down the street from the Bonds office. My family has shopped there for as long as I can remember, and it ranks on a par with the funeral home and the beauty salon for dishing dirt. Lula parked at the curb, and we went straight to the deli counter. I got a salad with grilled chicken, and Lula got a salad with barbecued pork, extra bacon, blue cheese, and a side of macaroni and cheese.
"I'm glad you suggested a healthy salad," she said, moving to checkout. "This is just what I needed."
I made a large effort not to grimace. Her salad was a heart attack in a takeout carton, and it looked fabulously delicious. I was going to have a hard time not ripping it out of her hands. "What's new?" I said to Gina Giovicini when I got to the register.
"Annabelle is pregus. We're starting a pool for birth weight, and if it looks like her husband or Reggie Mangello."
"She's been seeing Reggie Mangello?"
"He did some drywall for them 9 months ago when they fixed up their cellar."
"Anything else? Anything about Jeffrey Cubbin?"
"The guy who ran off with the old people's money? Nope.